I'm Joy Hughes. I'm the Vice President for Information Technology and the CIO at George Mason University. And I'm here in my role as co-chair of the EDUCAUSE Internet 2 Security Task Force. Jack Seuss, my other co-chair from University of Maryland, Baltimore County, is in the audience. And I'm also the co-chair of the Microsoft Higher Ed Advisory Group, along with Greg Jackson of the University of Chicago. And in a few minutes, we'll be hearing from our guest speaker, Peter Cullen, who's the chief privacy strategist for the Microsoft Corporation. On the security task force, we've found that we can't address security without addressing privacy. Every time our policy and legal issues working group starts grappling with security policies, it steps into the mire of privacy policies. And in EDUCAUSE, the privacy and security advocacy, its locus is under one person, recognizing how closely they're intertwined, and that is Rodney Peterson. And Rodney's here today, too. The Security Professionals Conference has become the go-to place for security professionals to go to get an enterprise view of security. But we work very closely on that with the International Association of Privacy Professionals. At George Mason, at my own institution, we started out just doing security, and then our president created a privacy and security compliance team that his chief of staff leads. And that compliance team, with representatives from throughout the university, soon discovered that we actually didn't know, I hate to admit that to such an august group, we actually didn't know who owned data. We didn't know who was responsible for keeping it secure. We didn't know what resources they had or didn't have to keep that private data secure. And we didn't know what were the sanctions if someone failed to keep it secure. So it was a tremendous learning experience for us the first year of our privacy and security compliance team. We implemented quite a few privacy policies. However, the various interest groups on campus, such as the Staff Senate, soon let us know that we were operating in an ivory tower. We write the policies, they have to implement them. And to the person on the ground, it's not so easy. So currently, our Staff Senate is writing a white paper on the information that they gathered on the hindrances in a university of keeping data private and what one ought to do about it. So stay tuned for that. That should be interesting. One of the hindrances I already got a hint about is the secretary whose department chair says, I don't care what Joy Hughes says, you share your password with the three student workers. Right? I don't know if that will make the report or not, but I'm sure there'll be quite a few of that ilk. One of the things we're going to do today is to see a video that the Security Task Force produced. It's a very brief video, and it's a follow-up in a way to the video we produced last fall, which was a conversation between my president and Jack Seuss's president at UMBC, and with Jack and me, talking about security incidents that had happened on our campus, talking about the horrible, horrific, unintended side effects of those incidents, and in a sense, serving as a warning to other presidents that they needed to get serious about privacy and security. As a follow-on to that, the Security Task Force held a contest, the Security and Awareness Working Group. They held a contest for the best student videos about security issues. We were going to give just one award, but there were such good videos produced that we ended up having to take up a collection, and you may be asked to give later, in order to give six cash awards to the best student videos. And the National Cybersecurity Alliance actually sponsored this contest for us. And we'd like to show you today just one of the award-winning videos. It's about 3 minutes long, and it's called Bob, You've Been Phished.
This is Bob. He's your typical college student with a passion for golf. Bob uses the internet for online banking and recently online dating. But like most students, the dangers lurking on the internet. With the Wi-Fi access at school, Bob is able to use the internet whenever necessary. Lately, Bob has been troubled by single life, constantly checking his email for a mate on Match.com. Yet another defeat. Only two emails. Let's see what Bob has in spam message from Enzyte? Could Enzyte be the solution Bob has been searching for? Let's go to the next email. Does Bob really think this is a legitimate email? Should Bob visit this website? Should Bob enter his information? Poor oblivious Bob doesn't even know his credit card is being stolen right under his nose. Suddenly, Bob is quite popular. Bill collectors are looking for Bob. Moreover, Bob can't seem to use his credit card anywhere he goes. Bob, you've been fished. Yes, you. Would you like to know what fishing is, Bob? Fishing is a form of person poses as a trustworthy source in an attempt to acquire sensitive information. Forms of phishing include fraudulent emails or websites, and even instant messages. They want sensitive information such as personal identification, passwords, social security number, or account numbers. Remember, be skeptical. Companies will never ask for your personal information. When in doubt, visit their website or call the company directly. Within a few short days, Bob has a new big swing of confidence. Bob now understands how to prevent himself from the online danger of phishing. He even managed to meet a girl from Match.com. Stay tuned for Bob's next lesson in internet dating. For more information, or to report phishing, please visit the following websites.
Thank you, Rodney. And now I'd like to introduce Peter Cullen to you. And this is a hard act to follow, Peter. As Chief Privacy Strategist, Peter Cullen is directly responsible for managing the development and implementation of programs which enhance the privacy of Microsoft products, services, processes, and systems, both internally and also worldwide. With more than a decade of privacy and data protection policy expertise, he serves as a leading advocate for strong and innovative personal information privacy and data safeguards, meeting regularly with global industry and public policy leaders, and frequently speaking at international conferences. In 2003, Peter Cullen was honored with the IAPP, that's the International Association of Privacy Professionals, Vanguard Award for Privacy Innovation for his contributions to the privacy profession. Under his leadership, Microsoft was awarded the HPIAPP Privacy Innovation Award in 2004, which is a testament to the success of the Microsoft Privacy Program. He's a founding member of the Association of Corporate Privacy Officers. He's on the board of the International Association of Privacy Professionals. And he also serves on the board of Trustee, a group which is dedicated to promoting privacy and trust on the internet. Peter Cullen holds a Master of Business Administration from Richard Ivey School of Business with distinction from the University of Western Ontario. Please join me in welcoming Peter Cullen.
Thanks, Joy. Thanks very much. Thanks for inviting me. This is a great opportunity, such a very important and distinguished group. The fact that it's sunny out, the fact that I'm from the Pacific Northwest and also from a technology company wearing a suit are at least three, if not four, paradoxes. I really want to thank you for including me on what is increasingly becoming a complex challenge for all of us, not just as consumers, not just as people in business, but also people like yourselves that are in organizations that are increasingly relying on information to provide value to your stakeholders. And it's a subject of internet safety or online safety. As the music man is fond of saying, there's trouble in River City. In River City, the citizens were waging a war against sin. Today, all of us are part of a war against helping to protect ourselves from online problems. The real problem is that this online threats are starting to impact on our ability to leverage information, and this has significant impact to all of us, again as consumers and again as organizations in terms of how we seek to use information. The really bad news is that it's starting to have an erosion on trust. Gardner reports recently said that 77% of people that are online bankers are doing so less frequently. 14% have stopped paying bills online, and 30% are recording that they are using the internet for commerce less. If you think about this in terms of the overall economic impact to us, particularly as we're starting to see some of the benefits of the internet and technology, this again has significant impact on us. But there's another area of impact. This is the impact of cybercrime, hacks, cybercriminals. In the FBI's recently released study on cybercrime, they report that this cost U.S. business some $67 billion last year. So in addition to the impacts on trust, it's having a fantastically bad impact on our overall bottom lines. The good news is that there is a group of people from the technology industry, other businesses, consumer advocacy groups, government, public sector, that are all banding together to figure out ways to deal with this problem. They're doing so by focusing on raising awareness, delivering technologies that can help protect people, thinking about proactive legislation that can be part of the puzzle to fix this. The real nut we're trying to crack is helping all of us realize the potential of technology, more specifically helping business realize the potential of e-business. Before we sort of talk a little bit about some of the problems, let's think about some of the objectives that I thought would be of interest for you today. The privacy and security landscape, as Joy talked about, is increasingly becoming intertwined, so I hope to give you a little bit of the picture. As well as the impact. We've thought about this convergence as something we call the internet battlefield and how this is directly affecting the threats to information flows, which, as I mentioned, I think has impacts to all of us. We've had a fair bit of experience with this, starting with, interestingly enough, dealing with spam and have thought about a three-pronged approach that's required to deal with these things. So I'd like to share a little bit about that. But in particular, how public and private partnerships can offer a very useful framework for dealing with these problems. And as I suspect many of you are aware, last November we urged Congress to consider broad-based privacy legislation in the U.S. So I thought I'd talk a little bit about that. And I know that what's been distributed is a copy of the paper that was released at that particular point in time. Let's talk a little bit about the landscape. In less than three decades, we've gone from a small user-trusted basis of PCs to over a billion devices worldwide. It's providing unprecedented opportunities for us to enrich our lives. It's also presenting unprecedented opportunities for us to stay connected. When we add to this the number of mobile devices from cell phones to PDAs to MP3 players, the amount of data that is traveling the globe is absolutely staggering. As Joy and I were talking at lunch, that it used to be that security professionals would focus on protecting the corporate database internally. Well, you know, this is now the new corporate database. So there's increasing problems for us in terms of both securing and protecting very important information, from personal information to corporate intelligence, corporate IP. What's becoming particularly important about this is that the bad guys are also finding new ways to attack us. And of course, this has impacts on us both in terms of financial, but also in terms of user trust. The landscape's becoming very, very complex. What used to be sort of kiddie hackers looking for denial of service is increasingly moving upscale to more of the criminal element. What's problematic about this is that some of the more sophisticated tools that are created by experts are now very easily available online. We jokingly say for $29.95 you can attack just about anything in the world. So what's the real prize here? Well, as the question was asked of Willie Sutton, so why is it that you rob banks? His answer was, because that's where the money is. And in practical terms, as information is the currency of value, it's increasingly become the currency of crime. Where this is showing up at a foremost is in the organized crime's entry into the information business. So this has huge implications for us as professionals in terms of both protecting information yet still allowing our organizations to leverage it. We start to think about this in terms of the internet battlefield. So we think again about those multitude of devices that are connecting to the web, where users have to worry about protecting data right at the threshold where they're connecting to the web, as well as on the back end, where bad guys are harvesting this data to be used for criminal purposes. It was great hearing about Bob and phishing, but if we think back, the term phishing really didn't exist about a year ago. So that's just how quickly this space is moving. If we think about spam, it's estimated that now about 85% of the world's email traffic is spam. And this is significant from a number of reasons. Less than 2 years ago, spam was an annoying fact of life. It offered us mostly products or body parts that we didn't need. Today, spam is a delivery mechanism for very much more malicious attempts, phishing being the primary one. As Bob talked about, it has a significant impact on people, not just financially, but more importantly, emotionally. I'm a little bit worried about Bob in terms of even if that date works out, his credit isn't going to be that good to be able to buy her a nice dinner. In fact, approximately 2 million people across the U.S. last year were victims of phishing attacks through direct loss. The other real problem is that many people don't know they've been attacked, which, of course, has all sorts of unintended consequences. To date, there are some 3,000 unique phishing websites currently in existence, some for as few as 5 days. In fact, eBay's reporting some sites are up only for a few hours. The bad guys are simply very happy to take a few or a few dozen pieces of information from unsuspecting users and leverage that. The growth in phishing sites actually is at 5 times per year. So it's a very significant problem and one that's not likely to go away. Again, if you're forced or given the choice of robbing a bank with a gunfold versus sitting in your living room and attacking somebody globally and anonymously, which do you think the bad guy is going to choose? There's an increasingly larger problem looming than in the format of zombies. Zombies are PCs that are taken over very unknowingly by the user. This is impacting not just users at home, but users within organizations, users within public sector. Users are typically tricked into loading code either through an email or some other download, whether it be drive-by or some music file. What this essentially does is puts the control of the computer in the hands of the bad guy to do for a whole bunch of other nefarious things. Botnets are a cousin of zombies, and put real simply, they are a group of zombies put together to create a concentrated method of everything from doing spam to denial of service attacks to virus attacks to all sorts of other criminal types of things. We're encountering botnets now that are as large as 10,000 zombies put together. In fact, the largest one that we've found was 100,000. So put into an order of magnitude, that particular bot farm harnessed together would be enough to bring down Korea in terms of their infrastructure. This is a very, very significant problem. Farming is also becoming a very bad problem. This is the distant cousin to fishing. But increasingly, there's another area, not just the fear of identity theft that's causing this sense of unease, and it's data breaches. Joy talked about the unfortunate situation that her institution was subject to. But there's a large number of incidents that are happening within organizations and within the public sector that cause us to think about how we're securing information. The state of California, the office of the privacy officer there, in tracking incidents of the last 113 data breaches, 55 of them have been in the public sector. So this is clearly an issue that faces organizations and public sector the same. The big opportunity here is, or the big impact is, how do we control this to stop the impact on trust, even beyond getting to the FBI study, where there was a significant dollar impact of some $67 billion. Probably one of the most infamous, or certainly one of the most noteworthy data breaches is ChoicePoint. And I think to illustrate the financial impact of that, we can take a look at what happened to them over the series of their event. That was a case where the criminal element managed to get out some several thousands of pieces of personal information. About 800 of them have now been used for reported identity theft. So in addition to the $15 million fine that the FTC just levied against ChoicePoint, they also managed to shave off $910 million in shareholder value. So this has some hard dollar impact on us before we even get to the trust factor. I'm frequently in debates with people within industry and outside of industry over the impact of identity theft. The recent Javelin report that suggested that the number of incidents have gone down. And this is a little bit like Chrysler saying, well, relax, you know, the exploding tailgates only killed 5 children. I think we've got to think about this fundamentally differently, but most importantly, we've got to think about this impact to trust and what this is doing for our inability to leverage the potential of technology. There's no silver bullet to this solution. We've thought about this and discovered that there are just, it's going to require multiple efforts across multiple different investment areas. And let me tell you a little bit about the three areas that we think are important and a little bit about some of the things that we've been investing in. The three buckets that we've just started requires certainly some investment in technology, but by the same token, technology without user guidance, without education, is just not going to be that effective. We've also realized that we're just but one player in this ecosystem. Industry partnership, both with public and private sector, is incredibly important to try and think about solving some of these problems. Going back to technology, we think about this from two very distinct levels. One is the multitude of products that are now available to help users protect themselves. Things like the anti-phishing filter that's now available in the MSN toolbar as well as the IE7. This helps provide an extra level of protection for users if by some chance an email gets through spam engines and gets to the user that they click on. Just a yet another very effective way of helping to protect users. But it also starts with how services, how products are built. For the last 3 years, we've been investing in something we call the security development lifecycle, which is implemented right from the design of products through the build to the way that they're launched to the market with some very prescriptive security protocols, some security processes. In fact, in December, we launched the first three products that were built exclusively from the ground up via the SDL process. Increasingly, this is becoming an important area, not just for companies like Microsoft, but we think about all of those peripheral devices that are connected to the internet. If we think about the applications that are in place in many of our partner organizations, learning to build these things with the proper focus on security is becoming increasingly important. In future, no product will release from Microsoft without going through the SDL process. So something that we think is very, very important. In addition to the products that we're building to help specific incidents. Prescriptive guidance or education is another very important area, whether that be from training IT pros and professionals on security, to working with partners in terms of helping them deploy, to helping consumers think and learn about ways to protect themselves. Probably one of the most recent and we think successful was a partnership with the FTC and the National Consumers Union in something that we call Stay Safe Online. You know, we recognize that reaching users requires a number of broad-based approaches. So in addition to the information that we provide available on Microsoft.com, we think it's very important to share that information with other partners so they in turn can help educate users in ways that they can protect themselves. The third area is industry partnerships, and this means working with partners in the specific technology industry. It means working with partners on specific issues, for example, spam, spyware, viruses, but it also means working with government, whether it be from law enforcement or from legislation. Data governance is an area that is becoming increasingly important, and I think Joy again mentioned this, as privacy is becoming more prevalent in the eyes of security professionals, whether it be from regulatory requirements or whether it be from a desire to at least adhere to our own standards or industry standards. This is becoming a very important time, very important topic. Data governance simply means how do we think about protecting data so that we're able to leverage the usefulness or the utility of it while at the same time as ensure it's both protected and used appropriately. For organizations, this means starting with a foundation of policies. It means ensuring that employees are educated. But it also means thinking about the right technology solutions and the right process decisions that can help guard against the inappropriate use or inappropriate disclosure of information. We think about data governance across three very broad platforms surrounded by a foundation of security and with a foundation of identity management. Increasingly, organizations are looking for ways to manage monitoring and access controls across all sorts of platforms and all sorts of applications. So thinking about this in a very integrated way is a way that my group focuses on helping the company deal with architectural decisions. We also think that for information to be leveraged, it also has to be protected, something we call enterprise content management, whether it's within the organization or outside. This is another very important area, again, as we think about information flows. And finally, roles-based access controls, making sure the right people have access just to the right piece of technology or the right application is something, again, that can help ensure that information is both protected, accessed, and used by the right person. In short, there are tools for building trust, and as we've come to understand, it really does require a multi-layered approach. Security is becoming a very, very complex problem. Just as we get better at hardening the operating system, the bad guys are moving up the stack to the application layer. And for all of us, whether that's we build applications ourselves or we rely on third parties to provide us with applications, this has enormous implications. And I haven't even got to those peripheral devices that all of us are using and all of our stakeholders are using to connect in today's digital world. It also requires a set of thinking about policies and procedures, about how, in other words, technology is just one aspect of it, but how does this interface with the processes, the way that users access information. And finally, legislation and enforcement. We've thought a lot about legislation, about laws, and concluded that, you know, a good law is a good law, but it's only effective if it's enforced. It's one of the reasons that we have partnered with law agencies around the world and launched over 100 actions against cyber criminals. But let's turn to legislation right now. We've become increasingly concerned about the situation in the U.S. in terms of the legislative approach and have concluded that it's time to look at a different framework. There were three principal reasons that brought us to this conclusion. The first one was the complexity of today's state and federal laws. To put it in perspective, in 2004, there were some 5,000 privacy-related bills introduced at the state and the federal level. This is just an enormous, complex jigsaw puzzle. The second issue is the growing concerns amongst users about how their data is protected, particularly with fears around identity theft. And finally, this increasing need for comprehensive measures to improve both security and consumers' understanding. If we go back to this complexity, users today are barraged with not really knowing whether their information is protected. It depends on whether it was offline, online, what state it was collected in, what state it's stored in. At best, this is convoluted. At worst, it's contradictory. If we take a look at even some of the 22 current state data breach notification laws, there's actually some contradictions even in the way that some of the states think about defining personal information. This is providing a labyrinth of complexity for consumers and for businesses that are trying to be meet the requirements of regulation. It's equally as confusing. We think a national framework that would cover both offline and online data is the way to go. As we've seen from the data around the way that users' trust is starting to impact their behavior, there's this growing sense of unease, this growing reluctance to leverage technology and the internet. So this is starting to impact us from a very real sense, both from a business sense as well as just ourselves as consumers. So we think this is an important area that needs to be addressed, and we also believe that today's patchwork legislation is not helping give people a sense of control. The other area is just a need to think about security in a fundamentally different way. It is becoming a very complex arena out there, and from our experience talking with customers, it's not that people don't know what to do or don't want to do the right thing, but it's a question of they're confused as to what requirements, what protocols, what processes, what technology. In our view, the legislation that we're thinking about needs to have these four basic tenets. It needs to be standardized across all organizations and across all industries. And as I mentioned, whether it be online or offline is irrelevant. In our view, the risks to offline data collection are equally as prevalent as online, so it shouldn't be precluded to that. We also see a tremendous opportunity to harmonize a U.S. approach with increasingly diversity of global laws. For many organizations that exist in a global arena, this is becoming a significant impediment to information flows. So another opportunity that a baseline legislation would address. One of the principal reasons that consumers are uneasy about data, particularly is the impact of data breaches, is this lack of transparency in terms of who has my data and what they're using it for. So we think a baseline legislation needs to address the issue of transparency, both in the way that consumers are notified, but also providing access to their information with certain restrictions. One of the fundamental things that the data is saying is that users want more control and more choice over their data. So we think a framework legislation needs to provide for consent for the collection of information, but do so in a way that is flexible for business. We also very, very firmly believe that notification needs to be done in simple, friendly manners, much in the way that we've approached something we call the short or the short form layered privacy notice across all our online practices. Perhaps the largest area of opportunity is in the area of security. We think that the organizations are struggling with what are appropriate security protocols right now and think that a common framework approach to this would dramatically help ease the confusion while at the same time provide an enhanced level of security for organizations as well as for the users of those organizations. So in short, those are the four things that we think should be addressed in terms of a national privacy framework across the U.S. We think that the state and the federal AGs both play a role in enforcement. We think that there's room for everybody at this party in what would become a very high-level privacy framework. In closing, I hope this has given you a perhaps a different view on the challenges and threats that we're all facing as information practitioners. But I also hope it's given you a perspective on some of the tools that are currently at play, both within Microsoft as well as with industry partners to help combat this thing, as well as at least one platform view of this in terms of our view of federal privacy legislation. I want to thank you very much for inviting me to the Sunshine, and I'm happy to take any questions that this might generate. Thank you.
We will use the microphone for questions. I'll actually walk it around. So if you have a question, go ahead and raise your hand, and I'll deliver the microphone. Yes.
Jack Seuss, University of Maryland, Baltimore County. One of the questions that we're all grappling with, as you refer to, is the myriad set of state regulations. One of the challenges, though, is what would Microsoft like to see national privacy legislation look like in terms of the elements that are part of a person's private area? Does that include images of signatures? Does that include driver's license numbers? Does that include university IDs? One of the questions that we're all grappling with is what actually is private beyond things like social security numbers that are relatively apparent?
It's a great question, and kind of touches on one of the challenges is that there's a fairly common set, a definition of what is personal information. And when you think about a driver's license or even a social security number, at one level, the driver's license number or social security number is just a number. But it is an inherent part of the way that we're identified and obviously is linked to other personal information, thereby default becomes personal information. In our view, the legislation that we're proposing, or the framework of it, needs to provide a level of control and choice for users, but needs to not get at some of the levels of explicitity that you might be referring in terms of what is included and what isn't included. Probably the greatest way to think about that is in the area of security. For federal legislation to get into talking about what type of technology to be used, in our view, would be a mistake. What it means, what we think is that organizations need to be given the flexibility to implement facets of the framework that are consistent and appropriate with the way that they do business. But so it needs to be very explicit in terms of proper notification to users. So if we take even driver's licenses, for example, how they're collected, how they're stored, how they're used. In our view, if that personal information is shared with a third party for a secondary purpose, that should require opt-in consent. Versus simple notification consent for the use of the driver's license as part of the motor vehicle world. So that was kind of a long answer to your question, but it needs to cover the basic framework of notification, transparency, security, while at the same time is not getting down to granular details.
Another question?
Tom Mayer from the University System of Georgia. Where does Microsoft think is the best place to go in terms of working with the federal government? You know, we have so many different players there. What kind of strategy are you looking at there?
That's a great question. One of the challenges, if we think about the financial services industry with some 8 or 9 or 100 regulators, in some parts of the world, a single regulator makes sense. That, in our view, is just not likely going to work in the U.S. Probably the biggest conflict is at the state and federal level, if you think about it. Our view is that the national framework legislation needs to be preemptive, but needs to also allow state attorney generals to play a role in enforcement. So to get kind of tie that back to your question, the framework legislation wouldn't necessarily designate a particular single regulator, but what it might do is set the bar for all of the regulators that are involved in all parts of the business. So if you think about the financial services one, if I'm a federal chartered entity, then the Federal Reserve is going to be my regulator in all aspects of it. They, in turn, would legislate or regulate against the framework. If I am an insurance agent and subject to state regulation, then the state would regulator would play a role in that.
Do you think that there'll ever be an end to the hacking, counter-hack cycle with a process like your SDL, I think that was the acronym you used? And standards seem to cut both ways, and so if we have processes or standards, some people argue that that makes our servers more vulnerable, and people are arguing that about CALEA itself, even though we don't know what the implementation would be. What's your sort of opinion on
talk a little bit more about the second part of your question.
Well, CALEA is the Computer Assistance to Law Enforcement Act, and my impression is, although there's no compliance standard that's been fully approved by the FBI, that we will be modifying our servers in standardized ways and giving more ready access to certain message streams to authorized people. But you got to wonder, does it give a leg up to the unauthorized people as well?
Great question. In fact, you probably asked it this way, but they're both are actually very connected. You know, the SDL is an interesting beast because the challenge is it's like a cat and mouse game. As good as we get at blocking one attack, the bad guys are equally invested in finding ways around that. We have a large number of kind of layered approaches to it with an attack and penetration team that are frequently looking at our products as well as our network, constantly thinking up new ways of exploiting, of attacking it, which then drive solutions, which then drive changes to the SDL, which then, of course, drive patches to previously released products. So it is very much an iterative type of a process. So my own personal view is that until things become so watertight that it just isn't worth the effort for the bad guys to attack, we're likely going to be continued to be subject to some form of bad actor. You know, spam's a great example of it. While 85% of the world's mail is spam, increasingly fewer of it is actually getting through because of multiple layers of defense. And I think this is important because it ties to your second question. Framework legislation or standards, whatever we want to talk about, need to be not as prescriptive enough that binds us to a current state when tomorrow's state is actually changing. So organizations need to be able to invest in solutions that are kind of mindful of the times, even if tomorrow changes. Now, for many organizations, they're not dealing with the myriad of products that a company like Microsoft is, or dealing with the notoriety of Microsoft. In other words, you're not subject to minute attacks, so it's less of an issue. But we, in our view, standards need to be flexible enough that still allow for organizations to take the appropriate measures. The challenge is, though, that the investments by organizations to make sure those appropriate measures are taken are becoming complex. So one of the advantages to a regulatory approach is that it does provide that consistent set of guidance. If you take, for example, the security requirements that exist right now in GLB, it's a pretty good start in terms of helping organizations think about layers of defense that they need to be to secure their network. For many organizations, it's just simply not an area of focus. And this is, of course, just another principal way in which bad guys are exploiting it. So it needs to be very balanced, not too explicit, but at least explicit enough that provides a workable framework.
Follow up on your recent point about regulatory. I mean, many of us are living with another example of regulatory compliance called HIPAA, which took 5 to 7 years to finally have regulations that are deployed. I think all of us wonder how legislation that encourages the government to do regulations is going to be timely enough to be considered responsive to constituents who really are quite worried. I mean, when there are commercials on prime time, you know, about data theft and identity theft, clearly people are worried right now, and I don't know if regulation could actually happen in a timely enough fashion to satisfy them. Thoughts?
I couldn't agree with you more. And, you know, I should have done a better job of positioning this, but we don't profess to have the apps. The bill's not written, let's put it that way. We think there's a need right now for industry, for government, for consumer advocacy groups to enter into a dialogue that starts off with the premise that the framework right now is broken. You've highlighted an excellent example of a regulatory framework which is complex to say the least. Even within that regulation, there are contradictions. So that's not necessarily a good model to think about. But nor do we think that the current model of patchwork bills is going to be the right approach either. We've got, 22 states now with a one aspect of a data breach notification, 19 more that are playing with it, about 5 bills on the Hill that are also dealing with it, yet it still only touches one aspect of it. It's what to do in the event of a breach. Doesn't touch transparency. Doesn't touch notification requirements around even how my information is collected. So the premise that we're starting with is the framework's broken, and it's going to require a broad group of people to come together to, quite frankly, deal with that exact same question. What our next steps are is to start that dialogue in an increasingly concentric way, starting with a small group of companies. In D.C., we were joined with Hewlett-Packard and eBay. We think the next stage is to expand that to another group of companies and so on until we start to think about how collectively we're going to deal with this problem. But, you know, the fundamentally starts with the premise that the current model is broken and isn't serving consumers, isn't serving businesses or organizations like you mentioned.
John O'Keefe from Lafayette College. I'm not fully up on all the various alphabet soup legislation that's out there. But one of the concerns at our campus is not just the sort of hack into our ERP, but the data extract that goes to Secretary so-and-so and has a Excel spreadsheet on his or her desktop, and that desktop system is what gets compromised and the data gets lost. So do these regulations cover that in terms of what can be extracted and what can't? And then secondly, what can be done at the desktop other than user education to prevent that sort of breach, which I think, at least for, like I say, our campus right now is largely overlooked because we're just so focused on, you know, the ERP system and securing that. And in many respects, the desktop is where it's going to happen.
Sure. Great question. In our view, this is exactly why framework legislation is needed. It should not specify whether information is residing in databases on the operating system or on desktops or with an outsourced third party. The bottom line is that organizations are responsible for protecting data and at the same time need some help in terms of guidelines as to how that might look like. To your specific question about desktop, there's a range of solutions that are available today. The one that, of course, you know, I'm not in sales, so I'll tell you about a Microsoft product, but please don't look at it as a sales pitch. But rights management service is a piece of technology right now that's used within our company and others to help protect emails, to help protect documents, to help protect data in everything from Excel spreadsheets to Word. It puts constraints around who can access the data, what they can do with it. It disables print functions. So that's an opportunity that you might want to have a look at. I can give you my email address, and I'm happy to point you in the right direction. But there are a host of different ways of doing it. But, you know, the user education, don't underestimate that. That's an enormous challenge because a lot of these things need to be controlled at the individual user level. They can't be controlled at the desktop level. So RMS is one that can be. I can send a document to you or email with you that tells what rights I give you. But conversely, if you're putting data on an organization's SharePoint, if you don't secure it with ACLs, then it can be easily found by just about anybody, including a search engine. So this is a, kind of the complexity of it, that it requires a multiple levels of investments from policy, process, as well as technology.
This is Joe Askins from Arizona State University. I have a little difficult time defining what personal information should be protected. Earlier, it was just mentioned Social Security number, credit card number, banking number. Those all have a link to financial security. But as technology continues to change, I think the definition of personal information has to change. And just one example is my address and my phone number and those of my family, my sons, with my grandchildren, are published in books and they're accessible all over the internet. And then as soon as someone would want to do something to one of my grandchildren, they simply have to go on the web and key in the address or key in the phone number, and they can see the entire neighborhood. They can see access and points of getting away. They can see what bushes are around my grandchildren's house. They can see whether they have fences or not. And they can find out a lot of this information because they go to chat rooms and maybe one of my grandchildren might give their phone number to someone. So I think the definition of personal information will continue to change as technology changes on the internet. Any response?
Yeah, I think you're right. Starting at kind of the core of your question, personal information is generally any information that identifies an individual. And that includes information that could be or is linked to an individual. My bank account number by itself is just a number, but when you associate it with my name, it becomes personally identifiable information. The same thing with IP addresses. In and of themselves, they don't identify diddly squat. But if it's associated with my name, then it becomes personal information. You know, the larger issue that you're raising is again kind of another example of that legislation is simply just one piece of the puzzle. Technology is another piece of the puzzle. But user education, starting off with, you know, how do you start to educate your grandchildren that it's probably not the best idea to be putting pictures of themselves or personal information on chat rooms or on MySpaces or whatever equivalent. So this is kind of the wonderful world that we live in, where we have this capability of an internet of technology that enriches our lives, but also brings with it some things that need to be sort of managed. And again, an example where a multi-pronged approach is required.
Dave King from the Indiana Higher Education Telecommunication System. You mentioned user education a couple times here. Does Microsoft have content or training materials? I mean, I think the video was excellent in as much as it took one concept and hit it very cleanly. A lot of our users are grandkids or the other end of the spectrum, new users who are in the senior citizens, and that kind of thing is absolutely necessary. We can't bring them anything complicated.
Yes. There's a host of material. A couple of examples. I mentioned the Stay Safe Online site. We physically go into schools in the state of California to do user education. We've partnered with Teen Angels to help educate users with that. The AARP frequently uses some of our material to educate their 55 million subscribers on that. So this is kind of a multi-pronged effort that we make that information very, very available. You're welcome to borrow any of the material. If you look at some of the privacy and security information that's on our website, for example, it includes flash videos of how to identify a phishing scam, how to protect user information. All that information is we're happy to give to somebody, particularly if it means sort of furthering the education.
Peter, I want to ask one last question about next steps before we conclude. But before we do that, I do want to clarify that the videos you just saw there are actually one of 25 videos that are on the website, the Security Task Force website, that are available for free for any institution to use, ranging on topics from use of passwords to phishing to identity theft, fraud, and the like. And the staysafeonline.org that you're talking about is the same National Cybersecurity Alliance that funded the video contest. So the staysafeonline.org, or the Cybersecurity Alliance, in fact, is housed in the EDUCAUSE office in D.C., the executive director. So EDUCAUSE and the task force has created some very close ties, and we appreciate the support on the awareness front. The final question I wanted to ask, just in terms of where we go from here, is one of your frameworks talks about standards across industry and organizations. And one of the things I have found in our own task force work on cybersecurity issues is that, you know, there's not always common interest across organizations and industry. And another way of cutting it is not just public sector, private sector, but it's for-profit and nonprofit. And I think one of the struggles many of us in the room will face is we're part of educational institutions that are nonprofit, that have very different governance structures, are part of non-regulated environments, unlike the financial sector, et cetera. So what are your thoughts about where higher education fits into the framework you're proposing and what kind of iterations we may want to have around this topic of privacy?
You know, at the core level, kind of tying back to one of my other remarks, that if we take issues like spyware, like phishing, that's just a kind of a great example where you can't go anywhere unless you have a broad cross-section looking at exactly definitions about what exactly is spyware, what's the difference between malicious versus devious. So that's one area that we invest very heavily in. On specifically your question about public sector, I think that the public sector, particularly this group, should play a very key role in terms of one of those concentric circles. As we start to broaden the framework discussion, you would be absolutely critical to that discussion, since ultimately, you may be part of it, be part of the kind of the output of that. So absolutely, maybe we can talk about how that might look like. Thank you very much. Joy, thank you. Pleasure. Let's stay in touch on that other thing, too.